Okay, that's what Dead Air sounds like, and this is the Peace and Justice program. Couldn't quite get the turntable to work. I was trying to play you a little Sweet Honey in the Rock for a segue from Radio Free Chico into the Peace and Justice program. My name is Chris, and this show's on every Friday with alternating hosts, and today I am really, really happy to have with me by phone from Brooklyn, New York, Ruth Benn, coordinator of the National Wartax Resistance Coordinating Committee since 2003. She's also the co-editor of Wartax Resistance, a guide to withholding your support from the military. Ruth, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that. I know things have really gotten busy in the last week or so. Is this true?
Mm-hmm. They seem to be picking up, yes.
Yeah. So what we need to do, I think, is to go back a little bit and talk about Wartax Resistance. First of all, what is it, who does it, and why?
Well, it's a form of action of civil disobedience, generally, not always, in protest of wars. And often people who get involved in Wartax resistance are objecting to a particular war at the time they start resisting. Now we seem to be in the era of endless wars. So some people are doing it in response to that, or just in general the military budget, which is a huge portion of the federal budget, of where our federal income taxes go. And it's about 50% anyway. It might be more, and that also includes a big chunk of the Department of Homeland Security and some of the other departments, the Energy Department, which is where nuclear weapons are budgeted and paid for. So it's various portions of the budget that fund a lot of the military. So a lot of people look at that and say, if so much money is going into the military portion, then there's so much less for all the other good things that we could be doing with our money, and all the needs that are out there, from infrastructure to climate and earth protection and just basic human needs.
You know, in the past, the only time I can really get people to listen to me when I talk about Wartax resistance is on tax day, when people are very riled up about how much of their taxes are going to things that they don't even know what they are. When they look at the tax pie, they get upset. And so can you give us a little more information about why it might be upsetting to the American people when they see how much of their money is going toward the military?
Well, of course, I have to say there are a lot of people in this country who think that's kind of the only thing the federal government should be doing, is a sort of defense, and that somehow everyone else should fend for themselves. But I think people who, you know, recognize that this country has incredible resources and a lot of wealth see that there are so many needs that could be filled, and for everyone, not just for select people. I mean, just the bridges and roads that need to be fixed, investment in clean energy, all kinds of different things in our budget that are crying out for funds. Many local communities are finding it harder to fund the schools. And so there is this feeling among a lot of people who look at the budget and see that huge portion of military money that money is really being wasted. There's just, aside for cost overruns in the Pentagon, the damage that it does overseas in other countries, killing people and not really making us safer, is wasted money. It's just such a huge loss of life and wealth that could be used otherwise. So, I think so many people look at that, and that just cries out for change. And it's a long time struggle. Obviously, this organization has been around for almost 35 years now, but there were other Wartax resistance organizations before ours. Of course, people can go back to Thoreau, but particularly since World War II, during World War II, the Wartax resistors who started refusing to pay federal income taxes or some of the special taxes for World War II, because a lot of them came from a pacifist perspective and didn't believe in any war. But a lot of, from that time on, there have been people who have begun to demand this shift from this budgeting for destruction to budgeting for the earth and for people and for life.
Yeah, that was an A.J. Musty quote I like. I think I found it on your website. Is the two decisive powers of the government with respect to war are the power to conscript and the power to tax. And so our tax dollars are like proxies for us going to war every time we let that money be collected out of our paychecks. It is really a daunting thing when people don't support the wars, haven't supported the wars, and still carry the burden that they're paying for the wars.
Right.
Yeah. So one of the little tweets I found on Facebook today really also piqued my interest in people making these connections. It was $20 billion for a wall of hate, but can't fix the pipes in Flint, Michigan for $55 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think people are starting to really see that this money of the United States is so huge, and it's being wasted on things that aren't going to make us safer, like you said. So, war tax resistance, you said it's been around since before Thoreau, and there have been mostly conscientious objectors, people of historic peace churches and others who felt really deeply about this. But now we have different motivations with the Trump administration, perhaps, and there's some talk among war tax resistors about broadening the call. What does that mean?
Well, I don't think I know exactly what it means yet. I mean, I think, yes, there have always been tax resistors of various sorts in general, which, would be people who are looking at other issues that they don't want to pay for, and all kinds of tax protesters of all sorts, or people who don't believe in the income tax to begin with. But in terms of the broadening the call now, a lot of people are looking at the whole Trump agenda of this new administration, and it isn't just Trump, of course, although we don't really know how his relationship with the Republican Party is going to go. He certainly has a lot of support. So it is a whole new administration perspective that a lot of people are objecting to. The border wall, certainly among them, militarization of the police, and just kind of the racism and in the justice, so-called justice system in this country, the prisons, mass incarceration. So some of these things tend to be more state issues in terms of the actual budgeting, but there are federal prisons, and so there is a federal death penalty there. So there are, and it will be the federal government that would build this addition to the wall, presumably, since there already is a wall. So people are looking anyway at a lot of these other issues, and also feeling like we need a whole sort of cultural shift that, is symbolized in some ways by how we spend our tax money. So we'll see how the conversation goes. I think, from my own perspective, I see the military budget, the money that's going to the military and violence, as being connected to all these issues. The wall and the border militarization that already exists is funded through Homeland Security, or even TSA on the airplanes, where you have armed guards on airplanes. These things are funded through Homeland Security. So there's Homeland Security, there's the Pentagon, the Justice or the State Department has a lot of military spending for there's so-called security overseas, guarding the U.S. embassies around the world and things like that. So there are a lot of different areas that I think war tax resistance always touches on. But if people are looking at tax resistance, they also are finding us, because war tax resistors have been doing this for quite a long time and have a lot of information. So we're happy to share that in whatever way we can. And, of course, our website is being found by lots of different people as a resource about how to resist, what the consequences might be if you're actually refusing to pay. Some people live below taxable income, and that can be a legal way to refuse to pay federal income taxes. So there are different ways to do it with varying levels of consequences and risk.
Yeah, and so for people who don't know about the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, if you just type in the initials NWTRCC or NUTRC.org, you will be able to get to that page. And it's more complicated in some ways than what we can talk about today on the air. But tell us about some of the different ways that people resist.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you alluded to before, it also does somewhat have to do with what your motivations are. There are people who absolutely don't want a penny of their money going to violence or the military, and some of those people make an effort to live on a very low income and just live off, you know, stay out of the system as far as they can, and just not be noticed, not be counted by the IRS and the government. It's a little harder to do that these days, but we have plenty of people in our network who do live on low incomes and are able to barter and use other systems and, you know, find other ways to have housing that may be shared or whatever in community that help them to live on a very low income. For myself, I've always been more from the protest angle. So I'm not a religious person, but I found myself working against war maybe quite a while ago now, 30 years ago or so. And I just couldn't reconcile working for peace and paying for war. But I had always filed, and so I kept filing, and so a lot of us file and fill out the form as you would if you were going to pay, but then just not pay and enclose a letter that says, this is why I can't pay. And, of course, that opens you up to higher risk because the IRS has your name and address and they know how to find you. But that is one way. And some people refuse 100% of the federal income tax that's owed. Some people decide to just resist a portion of it. And we may see people now who are saying, you know, let's all refuse to pay $100 this year if we owe $100, if we owe. And as our protest against, you know, what's going on or some particular aspect. And, or, you know, some people refuse less, or some people go by the War Resisters League pie chart, which is usually around 50% of the federal income tax that's going to war, and decide to refuse 50%, do a certain percentage of the budget as far as choosing what to resist. And many of us who do refuse to pay our money to the IRS do send it to the things that we would like to see funded, you know, maybe to soup kitchens or to programs for young people. Or some people actually have taken checks to their county offices and said, I'm giving this to you instead of the federal government. A lot of times people do ceremonies around it or put it into what we have is a network of alternative funds where people can also put money into those funds, and the funds make grants out of the interest on that money to various organizations. And then if the resistor gets collected on and needs some of the money back, they can have it back. So there are some safeguards in it all. But there, yeah, it's kind of a range of choices that people can make. And I should also say a lot of people are also trying to figure out how to reduce their income and take credits and deductions in ways that lower their taxable income so that they're paying less.
Yeah, and so a lot of people have worked out ways that the consequences are less, and a lot of people use the alternative funds. And also there's another thing that people do, which I participate in. It's called the War Tax Resisters Penalty Fund. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the penalty fund is managed by volunteers, and it's also, there's a link for it on our website also. And people who get on the mailing list or the email list for the penalty fund all are willing to contribute if somebody is collected on. So war tax resistors who've had a collection will send a letter to the penalty fund saying, this much interest and penalties were collected, you know, from me, and if I could get a reimbursement, that would be great. And so everybody who's on the list, we divide that amount by the number of people on the list. And usually, like, it's a matter of sending in maybe $30 or something, two or three times a year, I guess, is when they put these appeals out if people have applied. Yeah, so that we share in some of the consequences that way.
Yeah, and I think that's a really valid thing, because a lot of people don't feel that they can do vortex resistance. They're too frightened for their property or their families or the different things that root us here. And so they're looking for either symbolic actions or ways perhaps to support other people so they can do stronger vortex resistance, and so that would be one of them. What about symbolic?
I just want to say it's another reason why, if people, you know, feel that fear of resisting, if I don't pay the IRS, you know, they'll come and take me away. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, we should say that being jailed for this is very, very rare. It's quite unusual.
Right.
But the power to collect by the IRS is strong. And so to start out small is not a bad idea. You know, resist $10, something that if the IRS takes it with interest and penalties, it won't be so painful, you know, for people who feel they can do that also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know for me, I've been, I don't file and haven't since 1980, but that was before computers. And so, but I have certainly had garnishes and liens and some of the different things that can be pretty stressful. But, like you, I could not, it was during Reagan, and I could not pay for nuclear weapons that could perhaps, you know, kill my newborn daughter. So that's what got me started. And then every year, I think, well, now I'm going to end this. I'm going to pay and have my life freed up. And every year, I couldn't. So I just never, I could never quite get on the wagon with the people who are paying for these wars and for the preparation for wars and for the whole sordid research and development and drones, and every single piece of this is just so gut-wrenching. So, I mean, I would cry every year. I would go through like a big whoop-de-doo about it, and then just say, nope, I can't.
Right.
That's my story anyway.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the reasons that this organization exists, and it really is mostly volunteers. We have three part-time consultants, you know, myself, I'm part-time, and two others who work for the organization, but it is mostly run on volunteers, and it really is sort of a resource center and a network to connect people who are interested in this kind of resistance and also to help with support. So we do encourage people, if you're starting to resist or if you're a long time resistor, it really helps to have a local group that you can meet with, even a few other people. You know, a lot of times when I go to meetings, somebody will bring in their letters from the IRS that they haven't opened yet because they're afraid to open them alone. But, you know, in a group, they feel much better, like, okay, I can open this now and let's see what it is. And it's usually just another collection letter, but it does help to have people around you and to be in touch. And we do have a lot of social media and online ways that people can connect also if you're pretty isolated. So I think that's important to, you know who can I ask if a letter comes from the IRS?
Right.
What do I do next?
Right. And there is, here on the West Coast, we have the people in the Bay Area, but none here in Chico, although there are some sprinkling of vortex resistors that are living kind of quietly. But in terms of the basics of vortex resistance, you've mentioned, I mentioned non-filing. We mentioned paying partially or refusing all of it.
Living below
the taxable. Is there anything else? Like, can they take your Social Security? Can they take your... Tell us just a little bit more of the fine-tuning of all of this.
Sure. And actually, I should mention also step one for a lot of people who are employees and file a W-4 when they start a job. They have withholding, and so they think they can't resist because the money's already being taken out of their paycheck. And we should mention that when you fill out the W-4, one thing the IRS, is really looking for is to even it out. They don't really want people to get big refunds. That's your money that the government has borrowed interest-free. So So if you're getting a refund, you should think about taking another allowance or two on your W-4, which means that less will be taken out of your paycheck. And you may or may not owe at the end of the year, but even taking an extra allowance, if you're giving the government less of a loan, that's one way to look at a very sort of dipping your toe into making a change in how you pay your taxes and think about them. A lot of people think about that refund as like a bonus at the end of the year, but really it is just your money that's been borrowed. We have a lot about W-4 resistance on our website, and there are some consequences that are possible to that. There is some risk involved in taking a lot of extra allowances that would mean no withholding, but it's something people should read about and at least consider an extra allowance if they're getting a refund. Because you can't resist if you don't owe. So the people who are self-employed, like myself, it's easier because we're responsible for paying. We don't have withholding, so the government would certainly like to change that. But for right now, we don't have withholding, so we have more choices about resistance. In terms of other consequences, though, if the IRS thinks you owe money, if you end up filling out the 1040 and you owe and don't pay, or don't pay some of it, they have various methods of collection. Their best one is sending letters, because no one likes to get collection letters from the IRS. So a lot of people will get a collection letter and feel like they have to pay. Mm-hmm. And they have kind of a series of letters that get more threatening. And then they send one that says, it's called the intent to levy, that if you don't pay now, we can take money from your bank account, your assets, whatever. And usually that's what they're looking for when they collect, is bank accounts or salaries. So people who have salaried jobs, it also is an easier place for the IRS to send a levy to an employer and have it taken right out of your paycheck. So there is those are the two easiest, in some ways easiest things for the IRS to do, although they are inconsistent. And yes, for people on Social Security, the government allows, they have a federal levy program, which also is true with people who haven't paid student loans, that if at the point you collect Social Security and you have any kind of federal debt, your Social Security check can also be levied in that way, and they can take automatically 15%. It also seems to be somewhat inconsistent with people we know. Some have ongoing levies like that, and some it comes and goes on and off the check. So you don't know, but those are things they can do. And people worry about houses and property that can be taken, which also is more rare these days. And we should say it is one of the benefits for war tax resisters and tax resisters in terms of budget cuts to the IRS, because for whatever reason, the Congress has chosen to cut their budget a lot, and it has been more difficult for them to carry out some of the harder forms of collection, like seizing property. But that rarely pays off anyway. I think the IRS doesn't do it that much anymore.
Yeah, I think everything's changing. I don't think we can count on that anymore. But, we just have a minute or so left, mm-hmm. but I wanted to just say that every year, and at least in Chico, we do a tax day leafleting. We often have what's called a penny poll, so people can vote how they would like their money spent, and it's rarely for the military, very much of it anyway, just mostly veterans benefits. But this year, tax day is on the 18th, but they are talking about widespread demonstrations on tax days, because Trump himself has not surrendered his tax statements. There's very real possibility that he does not pay taxes. He just moves his shelves around like a lot of rich people do. And so what do you know about that, Ruth, Ben?
I've seen the calls online, too, about the April 15th demonstrations that have to do with demanding Trump release his forms. And, I think, we'll kind of, certainly myself will try to be out there also letting people know about, conscientious reasons to refuse to pay, as opposed to people who have good accountants, like Mr. Trump says he does, that, there are other other things to think about on tax day, I guess. I think we'll also be out April 15th and the 18th, which is Tuesday, is the last day to file. So we always do call for actions on those days and have events around the country. So
yeah.
Yeah, we'll try to be out there and, be with the wave of what's going on and see how it develops. But it's certainly an interesting period we're in.
Yeah, it sure is. And people are talking about divesting from the Pentagon. We're using these divestment campaigns, such as the BDS campaign, which is against Israeli occupation in Palestine, for a transition from fossil fuels, which is the a very big one right now, to get divestment from fossil fuel industries like the Dakota Access Pipeline, prison divestment. There's a movement for Black Lives, which is an invest-divest project. But so divestment from the Pentagon is a really big one, folks, so I hope that you'll consider it. And go to the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. And you can just Google war tax resistance and find them.
We'll come right up. I could give the 800 number also, because
please
people
do.
Are
Thank
welcome
you.
To call. It's 800-269-7464.
Okay, so Ruth Benn, coordinator since 1989 of this wonderful organization. 2003. Oh, I'm sorry. You've been a war tax resistor since then. 2003. Thank you so much for your work. You have been the backbone of, keeping me and many others strong, because we always know that there's people who can answer questions and can just be kind of a lifeline for those of us out trying to do these things.
So, yeah, and of course, Northern California War Tax Resistance in Berkeley, the Bay Area, is near you guys. So, hopefully you'll all work together too, yeah.
Yeah, and that's been another organization that's been around for many, many years. So thank you, Ruth, for
longer
everything
than
you're
this
doing.
One, actually.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for being with me today on the Peace and Justice Program on KZFR.
Sure, thank you, Chris.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, so I'm not really sure if I can get that song up I wanted to get up for you, but I did want to let you know that Brian Terrell is going to be at the Chico Library on Sunday, this coming Sunday, and it will be at 6:30 p.m. He's going to be talking about drones and drone warfare, and we have a very serious concern that President Obama allowed this to start. Now the CIA is droning people, killing people, assassinating people all around the world independently. We have a very frightening new administration that will stop at nothing in terms of torture or drone strikes or anything else, and so it's very, very important to hear Brian and to just get an idea of what's been going in terms of the peace movement's response and what we can do to become stronger, to get our voices out more. So Brian Terrell at the Chico Library at Sherman and First Avenues, Sunday night, 6:30, open to the public, no charge whatsoever. So I want to thank our underwriters here. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the law firms of Peter, Habib, McKenna, and Jewel Rhodes, LLP, specializing in civil litigation with an emphasis in personal injury and real property litigation. Serving the community since 1896, the law firm of Peters, Habib, McKenna, and Jewel Rhodes, LLP, is located at 414 Salem Street in downtown Chico. The telephone number is 342-3593, and by the Naked Lounge, locally owned for over 15 years at 118 West 2nd Street in the heart of downtown Chico. The Naked Lounge supports local art, music, and features tender, loving coffee, Chico Chai, Pacific Culture, and Tin Roof Bakery. Open from Tuesday to Saturday until 10 p.m. and Sunday and Monday until 8. The Naked Lounge also has craft beers on tap. I want to let you know that it's noon. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Chris. The show is called Peace and Social Justice, and I want to thank just a few more underwriters here. They really help keep us going. We're not public We're not an NPR station. We get no grants from the federal government whatsoever. So just the support of all of you local generous contributors and our underwriters. So please support our underwriters. So saying that, please support local, seasonal, and organic delights at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts with vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open Monday through Friday for lunch, noon on Saturday and Sunday, and for dinner 7 nights a week, with live jazz on Wednesday and Thursday, Sundays at 2359 The Esplanade. Visit farmstarpizza.com or like us on Facebook. And we're also underwritten by Disability Action Center, dedicated to gaining social and economic justice for people with disabilities. The Disability Action Center can be reached by calling 893-8527 and at actioncenter.org. So let me just see if I can at least get a CD working here, and then we'll get on to our next guest. Hang on, please.
I say the hungry should have food. I speak for many when I say no one should have 7 homes. While some don't have any, though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. And I say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere.
All right, that's David Rovics, and it is my great hope that I have on the line with me David Hartso in San Francisco. He is the executive director of Peace Workers and is a co-founder of the Nonviolent Peace Force and an initiator of the World Beyond War movement. He's a Quaker or a friend and has a BA from Howard University and an MA in international relations from Columbia University. Hartso has been actively working locally and internationally for nonviolent social change and peaceful resolution of conflicts since he met Dr. Martin Luther King back in 1956, and I want to welcome you to KZFR, and thank you for your wonderful book, Waging Peace: Global Adventures of a Lifelong Nonviolent Activist. David Hartso, hi.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here with you.
Yeah, and you know, when I have someone like you who has lived a long life and a life just totally dedicated to activism and peace, it is somewhat overwhelming to me just because of the breadth of your work and trying to encapsulate it down into a very small period of time of us sharing. But then also all of this crazy stuff with the Trump administration and the control of Republicans of our government right now, it brings everything, it amplifies everything and makes it harder to listen to the past, the lessons of the past. So I just wanted to say that starting off about, you know, how intimidated I am to do this interview, but I would like it if we could just kind of get to know you a little bit. I watched something of you speaking in Oregon, and perhaps you could tell us a story about your lunch counter protest in Virginia back in 1959 when you were a student at Howard University.
Yeah, it was actually, I think, spring of 1960.
Okay.
But, I'd be happy to. As listeners may know, four students in Greensboro, North Carolina, four African-American students decided on February 1st of 1960 that they could no longer put up with segregation of the lunch counters or anything else for the rest of their lives, and decided we have to do something. So they went to a Woolworth's drugstore to get something to eat. Instead of getting something to eat, they were arrested and taken to jail. And instead of that instilling fear in students all over the South, African-American students and their white allies found the courage to go out and do the same. So at Howard University, where I was studying that spring, we started going to lunch counters in the state of Maryland to try to get something to eat, as the students had done in Greensboro, North Carolina. At that time, everything was segregated in Maryland. Even African ambassadors at the UN, if they were traveling to Washington, could not eat along the main highway in the state of Maryland. So we would, on Saturday mornings, we would go to a lunch counter, a drugstore, to get something to eat. And instead of getting something to eat, they arrested us, and we would spend the weekend in jail singing freedom songs and building community. And that's the way I spent most of my weekends my sophomore year in college at Howard. And the state of Virginia had passed a law saying that anybody that challenged segregation in Virginia could get up to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine. And we were not quite ready for that and kept going to Maryland that whole spring. But by June, still no one had challenged that law in Virginia, and we decided somebody has to. We got some additional nonviolence training because the American Nazi Party was down there threatening violence to anybody that challenged the segregation laws. And we went down to a people's drugstore, and I think it was June 10th of 1960. Sat down at the lunch counter, and immediately they closed the lunch counter. Nobody would be served. But the store owner apparently didn't want the publicity, so he didn't arrest us. But so we sat there for 2 days waiting for something to eat. And it was the most challenging 2 days of my life. People came and spat at us in the face. People put lit cigarettes down our the shirts of our back. People call us every name in the book that they could think of, and they would punch us in the stomach so hard we would fall off the floor, and then they would kick us. Mm. Well, that happened, you know, all day long, and each time that happened, we would try to respond in a loving, nonviolent way, which was certainly not easy, but it's what those of us that had been inspired by Martin Luther King and by the four students in Greensboro, North Carolina, said, this is what we're about. We're not into hatred and violence and hurting the other person. We're into nonviolence and loving one another. And toward the end of the second day, we're getting pretty hungry and thirsty by that time. I heard a guy come up from behind me, and he says, if you don't get out of the store in 2 seconds, I'm going to stab this through your heart. And I looked in his hand, and here was a switchblade, you know, half an inch or so from my heart. And I thought, well, I have 2 seconds to decide, can I really be nonviolent with this guy, or is there some other way I should try to deal with him? 2 seconds is not a very long time to figure that out. But we'd had a lot of practice, and I just looked at him in the eye, and I said, friend, do what you believe is right, but I'll still try to love you. And it was quite miraculous. This hatred in his face, his jaw began to drop, and the knife in his hand, which was right at my heart, began to fall, and he left the store. Mm-hmm. Well, for a young 20-year-old, that was a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah.
But about the power of nonviolence. And but then we did something even more challenging. It had been in the front page of the newspaper, and so there were about 500 people outside threatening violence against us. And we went to the front door of the drugstore, and we read a statement saying, we believe, and we think most people believe, that we're all children of God, and we're all brothers and sisters, and we want justice. Every person has a right to eat at a lunch counter. And we are appealing to to the religious community and the community leaders to use your influence to get the eating facilities open to everyone. And then we said, if nothing changes in a week, we'll be back. And that was the very difficult, challenging part, was we'll be back. And we, some friendly media people got us out of there alive, back to Washington, and we literally shook in our shoes for the next 6 days.
I can imagine. Wow.
Did we really have the courage to go back and do that again?
Mm-hmm.
And on the sixth day, we got a phone call that the religious and community leaders had met, had talked with the business leaders, and gotten a commitment that the eating facilities would be open within 10 days. So we breathed a very big sigh of relief. We weren't really looking forward to 6 months in jail or the $500 fines. And that experience has really influenced the whole rest of my life. That, you know, when something terrible is happening, we don't have to just curse the television set or the president or segregation or war. We can find some other people that believe as deeply as we do about something we care about, and go out and nonviolently confront that injustice or that the manifestation of that violence. And as Martin Luther King said, you know, we need to overcome our fear. We need to overcome our feeling of powerlessness, and we need to keep our eyes on the prize. Keep that vision of a life and a society that works for everyone. And to realize, as King said, that the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice. There may be bumps along the road. You know, in Birmingham, Alabama, people got hit by the fire hoses and the police dogs, and but people said, didn't say, oh, we have to give up. This is too hard. They kept their eyes on the prize and believed deep down inside that we shall overcome.
Yeah, that's such an amazing story, and I'm so glad I got to hear you say it. It's so wonderful. But the thing about it is, people in America, I think, have been sort of busy not paying attention, and sort of what's happened here has sort of crept up on them, and all of a sudden they're looking around going, oh, we don't have control anymore of what we thought we had control of. It's a democracy that we thought we had is not there anymore. So we have to learn. We have to become students, I think, of what's come before and what's going on around the world. And what you write about is that there is good news, that people all over the world have learned nonviolence and built nonviolence movements, and there's been active nonviolence resistance struggles that have been successful all around the world. Can you tell us about that, and perhaps about Erica Chenoweth's work?
Yeah, Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stephan were two professors of political science and history. Did a study of 323 violent and nonviolent movements over the last 110 years. And, I mean, they were not peaceniks to start with, or Erica was not. She had majored in terrorism and really thought that, you know, violence is the when things get tough, you know, you have to use violence to bring about change. Well, they studied, as I say, 323 violent and nonviolent movements, working for big things like bringing down dictators and, you know, making major social change, not just getting a light at the street corner kind of thing. And they found that the nonviolent movements were twice as likely to be successful and as the violent movements, and were also more than twice as likely not to end up in civil war or revert to dictatorship. So for all the people that say, well, nonviolence is, you know, is for easy stuff or for sissies, they need to look at history. And what's exciting, and that their book is Why Civil Resistance Works, mm-hmm. which I highly recommend to people. It's available in paperback, and if your library doesn't have it, ask them to get it. And the exciting thing is that people all over the world are discovering that nonviolent movements are more effective than violent movements. And all the way from the Philippines, where they had one of the most ruthless dictators in history in 1986, overcame the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos, all over Eastern Europe, where there were communist dictatorships, nonviolent people power movements brought down those governments, I think without a person being killed. Romania was the one exception where they were using violence and lots of people got killed. I mean, where the movement was using violence. Mm. Liberia, there's a video about it called Chase the Devil Back to Hell, something
yes.
like that.
Yeah.
And where the women, I mean, after years of civil war, and, you know, killing back and forth and with, you know, all the civilians in between, the women finally decided, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Pray the devil back to hell. and nonviolently were able to force the government and the violent opposition to get together to negotiate. And then said, you're not going to leave until you negotiate a peace agreement. And literally surrounded the place they were, you know, having their negotiations. And brought down the dictatorship and now have a woman president, where things are well a lot better. So, and of course, South Africa, everybody in the world said under apartheid, this is never going to end without massive bloodshed. Well, under the leadership of Bishop Tutu and
Mandela,
and the president, I'm forgetting his name,
Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
They
brought about that transformation peacefully. The dictatorship in Chile was brought down nonviolently. So the movements in the Middle East, especially Tunisia and Egypt, brought down their dictatorships nonviolently. So. And in many other places. Of course, not all of them are successful. Tiananmen Square was, unfortunately, it was not successful. But I think that we need to realize that we do have the power. If one of the things about nonviolence, the traditional understanding of power is that the man at the top has all the power, whether it's a president or a dictator. and everybody else just has to do what the dictator says and believes. And the nonviolent theory of power is that person at the top only has power if the people will cooperate. And if the institutions of society cooperate, that means the teachers, the farmers, the civil employees, the police, the military, and if the people have realized, come to realize that they have the power, are willing to withhold their cooperation, and overcome their fear, and keep their eyes on the prize, as Martin Luther King did, that we can overcome.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing that you brought up about withholding support. Like, that's equally as important as being out there and putting your body on the line sometimes. Now, you've been called the midwife to the nonviolent peace force. You have been a big part of why some leaders of civil societies around the world still live, still do their work, and have been able to move forward. You founded an organization called Peacemakers and then Nonviolent Peace Force, which continues to this day to offer nonpartisan, unarmed peacekeeping with the goal of protecting civilians and reducing violence in areas affected by armed conflict. And can you tell us about some of your life's work with these organizations?
My inspired by meeting Martin Luther King when I was just 15 years old, and then my experience in the sit-ins, which I've shared, my life has been trying to experiment with the power of nonviolence in helping bring peace and justice and to our society and to the world. And in the 80s, I was a part of Witness for Peace and Peace Brigades International in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that that's when the United States was funding military aid to the Contras that were terrorizing the people of Nicaragua after the Sandinista Revolution, and was funding and supporting the military dictatorship in El Salvador that was killing its people. Well, we discovered through Peace Brigades International and Witness for Peace that having international people present with the people that were getting killed or being threatened with being killed could protect them. These were international people, not with guns, not even with slingshots or bow and arrows or any kind of weapon, but just by their nonviolent presence. And that's a long story, and you can read about Witness for Peace or Peace Brigades International on the internet or in books in the library. But that's an experience that I had in the Philippines, where the death squads were, first of all, again, U.S. supplied weapons were killing, were bombing the island of Negros because there were some violent guerrillas in the hills. And an area the size of Rhode Island was being bombed to try to get rid of those guerrillas. But of course, it was mostly civilians. So the civilians that weren't killed fled to church halls outside those communities or the areas that were being bombed. And I happened to be there at that time, and there was a church hall with 600 people. And the death squad had come and said, if you don't get out of this church hall in 3 days, we're going to kill everyone here. These were death squads.
Hmm.
We heard about this and went to the Catholic bishop who lived nearby, and he was in tears. Says, these people have suffered so much, where can they go? And we said, well, we shared some of our experience in Central America, El Salvador, Nicaragua, with international accompaniment, and his eyes lit up and he said, that's what we'll do. We'll invite international religious people to come and be present with these refugees. So he dictated a statement, and we faxed it out to many church groups, international church groups especially. And within 2 days, we had 25 international religious people in that church hall. And we had a press conference in which we said to the death squads and to everybody else that was listening, we're appealing to you not to carry through on your death threats. And to treat these people as children of God and your brothers and sisters. But we want you to know that we are going to be here with them. And whatever you do to them, you're going to have to do to us. And also, we're going to tell the whole world what happens here. Well, perhaps needless to say, the death squads decided not to kill those people. Often those kind of folks don't like to do what they're doing in broad daylight where everybody can see. So anyway, that was the inspiration to start the Nonviolent Peace Force, where the vision was to recruit hundreds and eventually thousands of trained nonviolent peacemakers who can go into conflict areas at the invitation of local non-government organizations or communities, and just be present, mm-hmm. and to help make it safer for local peacemakers, local human rights workers, local communities to work for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. So this is 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, we don't have thousands, but we now have more than 200 nonviolent peacemakers, peacekeepers from all over the world, from Africa, Asia, Latin America, North America, Europe, did I say? And who are in conflict areas. We've been in Sri Lanka. We're now in Mindanao in the Philippines. We're in Burma. We are in South Sudan. And we're starting a project in Syria. And have been very successful in trying to help protect civilians. And as probably listeners know, 80% of the people being killed now in wars and conflict areas are civilians,
yeah.
not soldiers. And so protecting the civilians is a very important first step to saying, war is an insane and tragic way of trying to resolve conflict. And Peace Workers, the other organization that I'm a part of, is working to support nonviolent movements around the world. For instance, on Jeju Island in South Korea, where people in a local village community have been struggling nonviolently to stop a massive new military base which is being built there for use by the American military as part of surrounding China. And nuclear submarines and aircraft carriers and various military ships will be headquartered there, and it's destroying their way of life. So for 8 years, they've nonviolently tried to block the building of that base. And so we've sent people over to be with them, partly to give moral, spiritual support, but partly to just say, even though it's the American government that is supporting this thing, we as American people do not support it. And that's part of what we need to realize all around the world, that we are one human family and need to stand with and support each other, not through sending arms or threatening nuclear weapons or any kind, sending tanks, but through human solidarity and standing with one another, as people have been doing in Standing Rock up in North Dakota.
Right, yeah, that's a good
example.
We're not
just saying, well, good luck, Standing Rock Tribe. I hope you're successful. Native American tribes from all over the world have come there, and veterans and clergy and all kinds of folks, probably including from the Chico area,
right,
to go and stand with these people. And that's what Quakers did with the Underground Railroad when trying to help get slaves to freedom from the South in this country. That's what we did in the Sanctuary Movement in Central America during the Central America Wars in the 80s, where churches and communities welcomed people that were had been fleeing the violence and injustice. And I'm afraid we're going to need to do that again.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to ask you in the last 10 minutes.
Both to Latin Americans.
Right.
And to Muslims, people fleeing the wars in Syria, etc.
So in this last few minutes that we have, I wanted to find out from you with the depth and breadth of your experience and your deep commitment, how should we, how can we be mobilizing our power at the current time?
How should we be mobilizing our energies?
Yeah, currently with what's going on with the Trump administration.
Yeah, well, I think one is we need to realize, I mean, as Martin Luther King did, that the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice. That even though it doesn't look that way when you look at what's coming out of Washington, we need to keep our eyes on the prize, keep our vision of the world that we really want to live in, and not succumb to fear. I think ruthless dictators and governments like to use fear to keep people quiet. And of course, if they're successful, then they've got 100% of the power. But I think it's obvious from these elections, the massive majority of the American people did not vote for Trump. I mean, at the most, I think he got 30-some percent of the vote.
Right.
So we actually have the majority of the American people did not vote for this fellow, and if we stand strong about what we believe in, he can make all kinds of threats and try to do things from Washington. But San Francisco, where I live, for instance, has decided we'll be a sanctuary city, and the police and other city officials will not cooperate with ICE, with the immigration police, et cetera, to try to round up people to send them back to us, to Latin America, for instance. I think when our Muslim brothers and sisters are singled out for repression, or our Jewish brothers and sisters, or our black brothers and sisters, we need to stand with one another. And I mean, just as an example, in San Francisco, many of us have signed up as honorary members of the mosque in San Francisco. So if they ever come after the membership, they'll have to come up after a whole bunch of other people too. So we are one human family.
Like to do that.
And I think you'll be talking with George Lakey in another week or so.
Yes, I have
but
him coming
part
up.
Part of what George is saying, and I also deeply believe, is we don't just go on the defensive. We need to build nonviolent campaigns to really both challenge the injustice and to work toward our longer-term vision. An example of that is, rather than just working to save Obamacare, that we actually really build a powerful campaign for Medicare for All, for a single-payer system,
right,
for free medical care for everyone. And I think there are a lot of Trump voters that are going to get disenchanted pretty quickly when they see that Trump is not doing keeping his promises for what he would do for them. and look at his cabinet and all the billionaires he's got, etc. Well, these people, we need to not just kind of brush them aside and say, well, they voted for Trump, they're hopeless. I mean, they want a human dignity for their families and their friends, just as we all do. So building nonviolent campaigns for the things that we believe in, I think, are very, very important. I know some people from Chico are, and some of us from San Francisco are working on trying to stop the drone base at Beale Air Force Base.
Right. Yeah, you've been arrested there.
That's a very important thing to do, but we also need to hold out the vision
that
instead of spending $1 trillion a year for drones and nuclear weapons and military bases all over the world, what if we spent that money to build a better life for every person on the planet? You know, a giant Marshall Plan, how much safer we would be.
Right.
I mean, and it's not just, you know, cutting the military budget by like a couple $100 million or whatever. It's really making a fundamental shift in how the United States wants to relate to the rest of the world.
Yeah, really keeping that vision alive then is what you're saying. You know, maybe part of the problem is just seeing it from the level of the problem rather than holding out that vision of how it can be.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. So in this last few minutes, is there any organizations you would like to promote or work that you would have us study or anything else you would like to add?
Well, I would encourage people, if you don't already know about it, to check out Campaign Nonviolence, which is people all over the country in who are concerned about peace, about the environmental destruction, about the injustice in our society, to work nonviolently to try to help change that. I think George Lakey again will talk about EQUATE, which is Earthquaker Action Team in Philadelphia, that is building a campaign to try to help both challenge the terrible poverty and injustice in Philadelphia, but also work for a renewable energy society where we won't have global warming, et cetera. And they are in for the long haul. And they're not putting their major energies into just trying to stop, you know, one bad thing after another. They're looking at a realistic vision that maybe if they keep at it for 3 years, they can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of things that people could look at.
So develop a long-term strategy that can be effective with like-minded people, I think you're saying.
Find a community of people. I mean, it could even be 3 or 4 or 10 or 15 people where you live or in your church or neighborhood or school who have a concern about something, a deep concern that you really want to do something about, whether that's in healthcare or Black Lives Matter or ending drones, or, you know, working for peace in the larger sense, and then look at your long-term vision, and then find a goal, an intermediate goal that will get you toward that long-term vision, and build a nonviolent campaign to help make that happen. For people who haven't read Martin Luther King, read everything you can get your hands on. Look at the film A Force More Powerful, it's a DVD about powerful nonviolent movements around the world. Be inspired by what people have done before. And then, as I say, after you've found those people and chosen an intermediate goal, build an ongoing nonviolent campaign to work for that goal.
This is wonderful. Thank you, David Hartso. I hope that people will read your book, Waging Peace, Global Adventures of Lifelong Nonviolent Activists, and learn a lot more, not only about you, but about the growth of nonviolence in our world. Thank you so much for being with me on the Peace and Justice program today.
Thank you, Chris, and thanks to all the listeners for listening.
Yeah, peace to you. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye, David. Thank you. It's an amazing opportunity I had, and I'm just so grateful always for the wonderful people and just being able to hear about their lives and what their thoughts are. So I hope that you will stay tuned to the Peace and Justice program every week as we continue to explore these issues that are more important now than ever. And I have in the studio with me two friends, one of whom is just here, and I'm happy to see her, Julia Murphy. Thank you for coming in. And my guest, Ryan Robles, who has been one of the key organizers of the Women's March in Chico. She came to us from San Francisco, and we are so lucky to have you, Araya, and thank you for coming in, even though I know you don't feel too well today.
Hi, thank you, Chris. Yes, I'm happy to be here, and my voice is not usually, I don't usually sound like this. I sound like a Muppet today, probably. But hi, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I think you sound better than you did earlier today, and I appreciate you coming in when you're not feeling well. That's the main thing. I had a number of questions for you, and then when I thought you might be sick, I scribbled over them and wrote down what you said, but I'd like to get back to some of my original questions, which can you recap a little bit about the Women's March and the speakers for those who perhaps weren't there or didn't have your bird's eye view as an organizer?
Sure thing. To recap on sort of how the day went, for folks that weren't there, it was a pretty much a very powerful day, I think, in terms of a gathering of multiple communities showing up in Chico. But folks from, I think, all around NorCal came. I mean, and there were folks that came from up north. There were folks that actually came from Sacramento to our march as well, which is sort of fun. It's kind of, it's been a blessing to be able to help galvanize and help bring a platform together for folks to represent, to gather in unity, and to show up for all of the issues that are, impacting everyone across the board. So, the speakers program that day was really wonderful, We started off the march with a welcome, and we had included in our welcome, folks from all. It was very intergenerational. It was very inclusive and multiracial, and also the one of the really, I think, meaningful things to us was that the really large presence of folks who have been marginalized a lot in leftist communities, even in here, like there was a really big Native and Indigenous presence for women and allies at the march. We had Black feminist folks, Black Lives Matter. We had folks that were advocates for the undocumented folks, immigrants, and folks, Latino, Latinx communities. We had folks speaking interfaith and also culturally from perspectives of, folks who are Muslim, but also just Muslim folks as our neighbors. We wanted to unite and say no Muslim registry. We had Asian American women. We had LGBTQ folks, gender nonconforming, non-binary, two-spirit folks. We had women's reproductive health and choice. We had Medicare and disabled concerns represented up there. We had youth. We had environmental folks. We had folks coming through for advocating for mental health, for advocacy. You name it. It was really a broad, broad coalition, and just every single speaker was amazing. It was really powerful.
It was. It was so amazing. And the only problem with that is then when you have something that's so. It was the largest march and rally in Chico history, I think.
Right.
And then So you have something that is that positive, that you're almost euphoric, and then you see what Trump is doing in the days that followed, and at that point, I took a slump or a trough, and I don't know if that happened to the other participants, but I think because you have continued to organize, tell us about our next steps.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, first off, we all make the next steps together, right?
Right.
So the Women's March came together as part of a national call. And, you know, I think everyone, if they aren't aware, it's pretty amazing. It's the largest one-day protest in U.S. history. And it was also joined by people internationally and globally in support. And that's unprecedented.
Yeah.
And also when I think about the fact there are so many folks who weren't able to be there, the numbers are enormous. It's pretty empowering. And it also speaks truth to power, you know? But I think the next steps are people regionally are going to identify what their communities need, and then they're going to be responding from a grassroots level to build up those responses. In the North State and in the Chico area, we're unique because we have some community and resources and really, really great, unique stuff, I think, to the Chico area that people can build upon or that naturally link up, like, movements for peace and social justice. You know, the fact that Earth Day was birthed in Chico, which is something to be proud of. I think all of the amazing potential here for, there's so many communities that come together because it is a smaller community. It's got a great opportunity. It's a college town. You know, we have a lot of amazing stuff happening on campus in terms of student organizing and community building on and off campus. So where I see the where the Chico Women's March fits in, it's A, we're staying together as a force and a community, and as a committee. We're going to be, available for rapid response as the need arises. We're going to still be organizing for women and allies and for marginalized folks, and we are going to, be there for some pretty great, I think, national connecting too. I mean, we're not going to just let all these networks wither away. They're just going to get stronger. I think people are really excited about it. And yeah, I mean, it's true that there's a lot of issues to fight against simultaneously. But the thing that I'm really blown away by, it's wonderful, is that there is so much recognition in each other right now. I think communities are like, hey, I see you, I got your back, like, you need this, we're here for you on this. You know, there's a sense of mutual aid, there's a sense of support and a collective responsibility. And I think it's really refreshing because no matter what the state decides, people are recognizing human rights and civil rights and going to maintain that ethos. So I think on the local level, we're going to be responding, and we're excited to say that we're going to be out there for International Women's Day, which I know there's been a few events in Chico in the recent past. You know, I'm still new here. It's been almost 3 years since I moved here. But International Women's Day is really powerful. It's just an amazing kind of history around recognizing the power of women. And we are going to be out there for it, so stay tuned on that one. You can follow, there's a Facebook page, Women's March on Chico, but additionally we do have a group if people would like to join it. It's Women's March on Chico Moving Forward, and we will be publicizing details as soon as the International Women's Day is the details are more solidified, rather. But yeah, it's going to be great. You know, there is going to be a need to have mass marches every month, honestly, across the U.S. and internationally for some time. And if we look ahead, we can say that I think there's a march for climate justice that's being planned for April 29th. Is that right?
Yeah, and scientists too. I know there will be something around Earth Day.
Yep.
And then you mentioned also May Day could become quite large.
I think May Day is going to be bigger than ever now. Absolutely. Yeah. May Day is always a huge, huge thing, you know, internationally. The Bay Area has a huge May Day. People are buzzing about May Day locally. I think we're going to see that. There's a... You know, been announced. There's just been announced a national queer march on Washington in June, and I'm sure this area would love to see something happen. And then going forward, beyond the idea of marches, just community networks, people taking care of each other, people feeding each other, people, building up more and more of the support from all the wonderful projects that are in town, you know, around, housing and education and healthcare and all of the ways we know we need to take care of each other. Advocating and for and respecting, you know, all of the marginalized communities and the folks that are going to continue to need things. Let's say if funding is cut around support for domestic violence survivors, we're still going to be out here in the community organizing to support that. We're going to keep those shelters open. We're going to keep those programs going. We're going to keep making sure that women have access to health, to reproductive health, to choice. We're going to keep standing strong. If anything, I feel like people are coming together more than ever. So that is really heartening to me. In spite of some of the administration's choices, and I'm personally a fan of saying administration versus one person as a figurehead, because if that person goes, which they most likely will be impeached or resign, in my feeling, there's a whole group of people who are propelling this, because let's face it, that person, who I don't want to say his name, the person who sits in that seat right now of the presidency, Trump, he is not a lawmaker. Okay, he's not drafting any laws. It's Mike Pence that's drafting laws. It's other folks. He's a figurehead, you know? And he is not necessarily the person generating this stuff. But